Okay, I'm going to start. I'm assuming more people will join us. I think some of them probably forgot about the class because the email reminding didn't go out till a couple hours ago. But who's ever not on can listen to the tape. And I was asked to say something before I begin about the Lashem Yichud. That was asked last class, and I said to hold off on it. So let me give you the information also about the famous responsum of the Noda Yehuda. If anyone wants more information on this, you can get it from this book, the entire book called Hasidic Prayer, Louis Jacobs. He has a chapter dealing with, chapter 12 is called The Polemic on the Recital of Lashem Yichud. Now, and let me just pass on what he says. The Lashem Yichud formula is not found earlier than the 16th century, but it is based on Zohar, which states that everything should be done for God's name, Hashem Hashem. And this ties into the idea of the exile of the Shechina, which part of God, as it were, is exiled. And until all the holy sparks are reclaimed from the klipot, the domain of the evil, then we're not going to be able to arrive at redemption. So we're trying to this unification, Lashem Yichud, unifying God in all his ways, and that includes taking in the holy sparks. Therefore, before you do a mitzvah, you recite Lashem Yichud. Now, the Noda Behuda's question, which we spoke last week, is as follows. He was asked about someone asked him about reciting this prayer, the Lashem Yichud. And in his strong response not to say it, he refers to the fact that the Hasidim were big into saying this, although they definitely did not institute it at first. And he quotes the verse. The verse in Hosea, chapter 14, reads, Ki yesharim darchei Hashem, v'tzadikim yelchum bam, u'poshim yikashru bam. It means the ways of the Lord are correct, ki yesharim darchei Hashem. And the just, the righteous, do walk in them, the tzaddikim yelchubam. And in the last part, uposhim yikashubam, and transgressors, poshim, stumble therein. Now, if you look in the Noda Behuda, he quotes this verse, speaking negatively about the people who pushed the Lashem Yichud, and instead of the word uposhim, he replaces it with chasidim. So it says, Tzadikim Yachumbam, the righteous walk in these ways, that is the ways of Hashem, v'chassidim ikashubam, and the chassidim, they stumble. So this is obviously a joke and a dig against the chassidim. Now that there's a legend that in the second printing of the Noda Behuda, the chassidim took out the word chassidim, and they put it back to the original, the poshim, and the Noda Behuda is said to have replied when he heard about this, that I turned the transgressors, the poshim, into chassidim, and here, what do? The chassidim, they turn the chassidim into poshim. But that's only a legend, because there is no printing of the Noda Behuda in which there's a change. They all have what I just mentioned, where it says his dig against the chassidim, the Hasidim stumble. Okay, what we're going to do today is we're going to conclude with Rav Avadya Yosef. I don't think it'll take us the entire class, and then we'll move on to Rav Yitzchak Zalman Meltzer, or maybe it'll take us the entire class, but we'll definitely conclude today. If you can remember 2 weeks ago, the last thing I said was that I wanted to talk about the opening volume of the Abiya Omer. In 1954, the era we're speaking about, the first volume of the Responsi Abiya Omer, which has become a classic. As long as people study Responsa volumes, they'll be studying Abiya Omer. It is the most, I think it's the most significant work of Responsa in the post-Holocaust era. The only one that might come close to it would be the Igros Moshe of Moshe Feinstein, but Yabiya Omer is much more significant in terms of its influence, and I think in terms of its lasting power. Obviously, during its era, Igros Moshe was the equivalent of Yabiya Omer, But Yabia Omar, I think, will stand the test of time. It's become such a classic work, which is the first place people go in a way that the Igros Moshe was not, for a variety of reasons, not least of which is that it's also used as an encyclopedia. Now, in the introduction, I mentioned how we saw that Rav Avad Yosef speaks about the study of halacha is supposed to be for its practical application. And the last thing I think I said was that this is a dispute, an old dispute over how to view Jewish, the study of halachic texts or Talmudic texts. Is it about arriving at some sort of practical knowledge, or is it study for its own sake? And I mentioned the Lithuanian approach, and that was the last thing I mentioned. Then he goes on and says that those who want to achieve knowledge of Torah to what he calls the Amita Shel Torah, the truth of Torah, and to rule in practical matters, they need to look not just in the recent authorities, the Achronim. He says they need to look in Achronei Achronim, that is, the contemporary authorities. Later on, he quotes someone who says that, you have all these people who it's almost a badge of pride to say that I don't look at the recent authorities. I don't look at Achronim. In yeshivas, they often say, I don't look at Achronim. And the reply to this is, well, if you don't look at Achronim, if everyone had your position, then no one would read your book. So Rav Avad Yosef is, says that you need to look as much as you can at the recent authorities, and he explains why. And he talks in this introduction about, that although he looks at the Achronim, he still, will dispute with them when he sees the need to. And it's a very important description of his approach to Jewish law. There's a number of other interesting things in this first volume, which would have got people interested in this his new figure on the scene and writing response, or Avad Yosef. For example, I'll just read you from the table of contents. It's a small volume, it's not very long. In number three, Or Chaim number three, he speaks about the issue of the tefillin of Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi. And he says that you should put them on those who wear them. And he thinks that, Talmidei Chachamim should wear them. He says you should put them on like the Ashkenazim do, one after the other, like if you see Chabad, not like the Sfardim do, or the Sephardic Kabbalists, who put them on the same time. So you're wondering, what does that mean, put them on the same time? Let me show you a picture here of what it means to wear tefillin at the same time. That's not going to work. Let me try a different one here. Okay, you should be able to see here. Here you see a rabbi. This is Reb Chaim Churi. He's a Tunisian rabbi, and he has, as you can see, two sets of tefillin on his head. We could not do that today with the tefillin we wear, because the here you go, here's one and here's another. The tefillin we wear are very big. These giant tefillin you see. My father bought my son tefillin for his bar mitzvah. They're these big tefillin. They're not the super big ones. If you look at old tefillin. Tefillin they used in Europe before the war. They wore small little tefillin, just like the strimals, which used to be about this big on top of the head, have become huge, almost like a spadik, and everything has become big. So too, the tefillin had become giant in a way they never had, because you're supposed to wear tefillin all day. With these tefillin are actually. They're not small, but they're not big like we have today. The one on top is a little smaller, but we know that there is room to put two tefillin on your head. And although today, with the tefillin we have, I don't know if they would fit, but there you see it. So, and this is the approach which the Sephardic Kabbalist used, and you can still see this today. So why does Rav Avad Yosef not support that? Well, he says, it's proven by proofs from the Talmud and from the Poskim, not in accordance with the see the this the Kabbalists, they wanted to put them on the same time because they have this conception that they're both equally valid, Rashi and Rabbi Yotam, and they both go back to the original giving of the law of Tefillin, And since they're of equal weight, then we put them on the same. And Rav Avadya Yosef says that this is not what you see. When you look at the Talmud and you look at the halachic authorities, no one assumes that they're both given. Rather, we assume that there's a dispute. Are you supposed to wear Rashi or Rabbeinu Tam? And Rashi didn't make this up. It's a big question. What does that mean? Rabbeinu Tam made it up? We know that it went back before Rashi and before Rabbeinu Tam, although it's identified with them. But not that these both go back to the beginning of time. Somehow, the tradition was lost. There were periods of time when people did not wear tefillin. In medieval times, in medieval Ashkenaz, we know that many people didn't wear tefillin. And at one of these periods, obviously, the tradition was lost, and there's a dispute over the order of the different parshiot. And that's what Rav Avadya says is the correct approach, or it's the approach, the standard approach, I should say, of the Talmud and of the halachic authorities, that there are two opposing viewpoints, not that they're both correct or they're both acceptable. We decide for practical purposes to go like Rashi, and so therefore that's the primary tefillin you wear. And if you're more pious and you want to put a Rabbeinu Tam tefillin on, you do that, but you do that secondly. There are actually four approaches to putting on tefillin. There are four different versions of how to wear tefillin. I don't know of anyone who wears all four, but you have four different approaches. In his responsum, he quotes something interesting that, first of all, he says that the dispute begins in the Gaonic period. And he says, what's this, if these two approaches, that is, how to order the tefillin, Rabbeinu Tam and Rashi, go back, let's say, to Talmudic times, and how is it that all of a sudden in the ear of the Gaonim, they start arguing about it? How come the Gaonim aren't saying, there shouldn't be an argument, there should be two different opinions? Instead, you see that there is an argument over the matter. And then he quotes Rav Yosef Messas. Yosef Messas is a very interesting Moroccan figure. We had a few classes on him. And he says that if you look in the Tefillin, there are two verses, two chapters that come from Shmos, Exodus, and two chapters, or two sections that come from Devarim, if my memory serves me. Yeah, two sections that come from Devarim. And he says that since Devarim was only written at the end of the 40 years of wandering in the desert, he believes that originally you only had the original tefillin, Moshe Rabbeinu's tefillin, were only the first two parshios. And then later, only at the end did you have the four parshios. And it makes sense, actually. I think it would make sense, at least. Because how could, Rav Avadya doesn't like this. He says, what you're saying, Moshe Rabbeinu didn't wear tefillin with four parshios? But it sort of makes a certain amount of sense, because if you're going to assume that the Sefer Devarim only comes later, and those parshios are from Devarim, why would you assume that those parshios were in the tefillin? So I don't know. Rav Avadya, he rejects this and says absolutely not, but he assumes that even though Devarim wasn't written, you still had these chapters. But I don't think what Rav Messas says, it's in his Mayim Chaim, is so crazy. One more thing from Volume 1. Look, there's a lot of interesting things in Volume 1, but we're not. I don't want to spend a whole class going through the different tshuvot here. He says in number 44, Orach Chaim 44. The only reason I mention this is because Moshe from Lakewood asks, wasn't the commandment only given? It's a good question. The commandment of tefillin itself, you're saying when it's mentioned. If you look in the Rashbam, he thinks that the Pshat, he says, this is one of Rashbam's controversial comments where he says the pshat, simple meaning of tefillin, is that it's not literal. So when it means that you put it on your heart and on your head, it doesn't mean literally wearing tefillin. It's metaphorical, symbolic. Now obviously Rashbam wore tefillin, but that's just his Rashbam, as we know, gives explanations which are in accordance with the Pshat. Now, as for your question, he thinks not. I'd have to investigate this, but he says that Moshe Rabbeinu and all the Kedoshim wore it from the giving of the Torah. That's on page, and he quotes a, yeah, if you look on pages 9 and 10, he's very clear. He says that all four parshios were given to them from Sinai. And he says, it says, totfot, totfot, you know, that drusha they make. And also we have, so you look in there, he thinks otherwise. He says that, yeah, look, I don't, I mean, take a look at it. You'll see, I'm not sure just by looking at it how he derives this. He says that the Parshios of Shema and Vayim Shemoah were said when going out of Egypt. Take a look at it. I don't see, yeah, what's also, the difference is though in Exodus, it doesn't use the, if you look in Rashbam, I think it's in if I'm not mistaken, I have to check, I think it's in Shemos that Rashbam gives the allegorical interpretation. Whereas in Devarim, if I recall, he doesn't give any interpretation. So therefore, some people want to say that it's only in Shemos that it's not meant to be taken literally, but in Devarim, it is meant to be taken literally. But I don't know. The other thing I want to call your attention to, or two other things, is number 21 here, only because something was recently written about this on the Sfarim blog, and that has to do with opening a refrigerator on Shabbos, which today everyone does, but originally there was a dispute over it, because when you open it, you might start the motor, things like that. And he says, he concludes that it's you can open it any time, when the motor's running, when the motor's not running. That itself is not so such an interesting thing for now, I think. But what is of interest is that he quotes the responsum of Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger of Brisk. Now, someone recently tried to write on the Sfarim blog that Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger, in his responsum, because he speaks about lighting the electric, that he was referring to, or I think he might even say Or HaElectric, the light of the electricity. I don't remember the exact language, that he was referring to having a light bulb on in the refrigerator. And that is such nonsense. I want to be respectful, but Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger was referring to, and everyone knows this, the family knows this. This has been written about for the last 70 years. Rav Simcha Zelig Rieger was referring to opening a refrigerator and starting the motor. There's absolutely no doubt about this, and yet. And someone wrote, this man Sassoon, pointing out this error, and then the person writes a whole reply, and, you know, sometimes you have a situation where someone goes on for 10 pages trying to make a case, and then people who don't know the subject look at it and say, oh, it's a dispute. You know, so-and-so says one thing, the other says another thing, as if it's not clear. It is absolutely clear. There never has been any doubt. And, of course, when Rav Avadya Yosef writes about it, he's referring to the motor. No one in history has ever said anything else. If the family knows this, the Sfarim blog never should have published this piece, because just because someone writes something doesn't mean it should be published. And I just mention this because if anyone had followed that issue, I want to call your attention to Rav Avadya. And finally, in this volume, the last thing I want to note, because it's relevant to the holiday we just had, in number 44, he asks Kriyat Megillah and Nashim, reading the Megillah, Megillah Esther for women, do you read it with the blessings beforehand? Hey, why would anyone think that you don't read it with the blessings? Sometimes they will read it. There'll be a special reading in the morning just for women. There's question of the obligation of women. The Shulchan Aruch says that they're obligated in it, but some say that their obligation is not the same as for men, and therefore they cannot read the Megillah for men, although we assume that they can read the Megillah for men, although we don't really do it. Okay, so he goes through the whole thing that because if a woman reads it, she makes the blessing with Shmuel Megillah, because she's not obligated into reading it. So there's a dispute basically as to her level of obligation. And there were people, because obviously that's why he wrote the responsum. There were people who thought perhaps that they shouldn't, and he says no, you should make all the blessings for them. And don't say, he says that this is to suffolk, and since it's a question of making a bracha levatala, don't do it, because he says we have a principle that a bracha levatala, that you don't say bracha levatala, a needless blessing, if you have a custom, and the custom is already to read it for the women. And okay, that's enough for volume one. The volume won the Rav Kook Prize for Torah literature. If you look in page 13, you have the text of the reasons given by the judges why they awarded it to him. And Rav Shlomo Yosef Zevin, I mean, he's the author of this text, where he says that we've begun to think, or some people think, that the Sephardic world has suffered a decline in Torah study. But take a look at this work, and you'll see that there's still as great Torah in the Sephardic world. The book also appears with the approbations of Rav Herzog, who's the chief rabbi. It didn't appear with the Sephardic chief rabbi, Rabbi Uziel, because he is no longer alive at this time. Instead, it appears with the approbations of Rav Chizkiya Shabtai, who was a based in Jerusalem, Yaakov Moshe Toledano, himself a very interesting figure, chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, Rutzi Pesach Frank, Rav Pinchas Epstein of the extremist, the separatist Edah Haredit. We spoke about Rav Ovadia Yosef's relationship with them. He had a good relationship with them as well. And the last approbation is from his teacher, Ezra Atiyah. These are all names we've spoken about in the past. I'll get to the questions and comments at the end. Just what Bill says about it, it's a dispute whether the Torah was given at one time or episodically, but everyone assumes that certain things were given at Sinai. So the question only is that was it given when everyone said the position that says it was given at one time means at the end of the days, at the end of the time in the desert, and the other position says as they went through the desert. But even the position that says it was given at the end assumes that there were certain things given at Sinai. It's just that the laws and other things. Volume two. Oh, before I get to volume two, since I'm going in chronological order, see, volume one appears in 1954. 1954 is also significant because Rav Ovadia Yosef opens up the yeshiva. Remember, he was in Jerusalem. He had left Petah Tikva, came back to Jerusalem. The yeshiva call is called Or HaTorah, and it was an evening yeshiva. The students, either they were at other yeshivas or working, doing anything else during the day. At night, they would learn in this yeshiva, and they were provided with a stipend. Among those who studied in the yeshiva were Rav Mordechai Eliyahu. We'll have classes on him as well. He succeeds Rav Ovadia Yosef as chief rabbi, Sephardic chief rabbi. There was enormous bad blood between the two of them for 30, 40 years, with Rav Mordechai Eliyahu representing the traditional Iraqi community, whereas Rav Ovadia Yosef had this break, as we saw, with the Iraqis. Also, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was more identified with a stronger Zionist position than Rav Ovadia Yosef. But the reason for the break was because of the position on the role of Kabbalah, on the Ben Yishchai, on Rav Ovadia Yosef's approach to halachic decision making. And then, when he was thrown out of the office of chief rabbi, that and Rav Mordechai Yahu agreed to take his place, when Rav Ovadia Yosef's position was that no one should agree to substitute for me because this is not correct to kick me out. Even though he was involved in kicking out Rav Nissim, and Rav Mordechai Yahu was Rav Nissim's close confidant and really his great great successor. So then, when it was time for Vlad Yosef, his position to be up, it was Rav Nissim's people who put in fact, Rav Nissim's son, Moshe Nissim, who was justice minister, and he was the one that arranged for this law that meant that Rav Vlad Yosef couldn't continue serving. He got the last laugh, as it were, in that he got to put Rav Mordechai Eliyahu in to take Rav Vadia's place. But we'll get to that. That'll come later down the road. But at this time, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, who also studied in Porat Yosef, then went to this yeshiva. So there was a time when they were quite close. Not only was he there, Rav Avadia appointed Mordechai Eliyahu as the person in charge of running the place. During some of this period, from 1956 on, as we'll see, Rav Avadia is back in Petach Tikva. He only would come to Jerusalem for Shabbos, but during the week he was in Petach Tikva because he returns again to be on the Beis Din. And during the week, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu runs this yeshiva. This is important, the fact that he was running the yeshiva and that he, but he was not a student of Rav Avadia. A lot of times people assume that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, you know, what he did was incorrect when he went up against Rav Avadia Yosef because he was Rav Avadia's student at this yeshiva. Everyone knows he wasn't a student of his in Porat Yosef, but it's not true. He was, ne if you don't want, but like Rav Mordechai Eliyahu being involved in taking over the chief rabbinate for Rav Avadia, that's fine. But this idea that somehow he was his student, his follower, and therefore he turned on his Rebbe is not true at all. They were colleagues, and I guess you would say Rav Avadia Yosef was senior to him. Rav Avadia Yosef is born in 1920. I'll check it right now. Was born in 1920. Rav Mordechai Eliyahu is 29. So Rav Avadia Yosef is clearly a good deal older, and he's a senior person to him. However, he was not his teacher. All Rav Mordechai Eliyahu did at this yeshiva was serve as an administrator. Yet Rav Mordechai Eliyahu was in his youth a great admirer of Rav Avadia Yosef, and Rav Avadia Yosef was very helpful to Rav Mordechai Eliyahu in terms of bringing him into his career as a dayan. Without Rav Avadia Yosef, it's who knows whether Rav Mordechai Eliyahu would have risen in the ranks of the dayanim the way he did. That all was in the 50s, however. Later on, as we'll see, they have a great falling out. This yeshiva of Rav Avadia Yosef only lasts until 1959, because once Rav Avadia Yosef is moved back to Petach Tikva, it becomes hard to keep it running. So what do? They join it together with Porat Yosef. But in those 5 years, many of the great Sephardic, future Sephardic authorities study in it. In 1956, during this period, Yabia Omer Volume 2, again, not a very large volume, that appears. This volume is significant as well, regarding some of the issues we've spoken about, because the dispute between Rav Avadia Yosef and his own Iraqi community heated up again with the publication of this volume, and it really reached a high point. And it was because of what he wrote in one responsa. And that is Or HaChaim number 25. So let me tell you about this responsa. I mean, we're talking ancient history now, but at the time, the dispute in this community was enormous. The issue is, get you the summarize you for it. It's a bit of an obscure halachic question he was asked. We all say Friday night we say Magen Avot in davening at shul if we're in a minyan, a continuing minyan, not in field davening by themselves. Don't say it. There's the question, however, do you say it? Well, actually, let me take it back. There is no question. You say it every time there's Shabbos, and every time Shabbos, even if Shabbos coincides with a holiday, you say it as well. You don't say it. The one time you don't say it, we'll see it this year, is when Pesach, the first night of Pesach, falls out on Shabbos, you don't say it. But other than that, you don't say it. Or at least I shouldn't say you don't say it. Many people say you don't say it. the problem was that you had these Kabbalists, these Sephardi Kabbalists, who claim that I believe it's Rav Shalom Sharabi who's the first one, and he is thought to have all his traditions from Rav Isaac Luria, and therefore this is thought to be a tradition from Rav Isaac Luria that you don't say Magen Avot for any Shabbos that coincides with a holiday, for Kabbalistic reasons. You'd wonder why people would get into such a dispute over this. So one community does one does the other. But that was the dispute. You don't do you say Magen Avot or do you not? And in the Iraqi community, because they are very influenced by Kabbalistic things, they adopted the position of the Ben Ish Chai and going back others that Chaim Palachi and numerous others that you do say Magen Avot. In fact, I think there's I think not only that they say it every day, including actually, am I wrong here? I think no, we don't say it. Someone can check. I'm just trying to remember. I think Sfardim say it because the Shulchan Aruch says to say Magen Avot Erev Pesach. Friday night Pesach, first night Pesach, but Ashkenazim, if I recall, if someone has an Art Scroll Siddur, check it out. Ashkenazim, if memory serves me, we don't say it. No, we don't. None of us say it. That's my memory. We say it every time. We always say it, but Erev Pesach we don't. But the Kabbalists say you do. Okay, so that's the whole dispute. Do you say Magen Avot Erev Pesach or not? So, in the midst of his lengthy discussion here over when or not you say it or not, he says as follows in explaining why he holds that Erev Pesach you don't say it. He quotes, incidentally, these figures that argue that if Rav Yosef Karo had known what the Kabbalists said and what the Ari said, in particular, if Rav Yosef Karo known what Isaac Luria said, then he would have changed his mind, and he would have agreed that even that Al Pi HaKabbalah, based on Kabbalah, you have to say Magen Avot, that whole section, not just Magen Avot, Birchei Anshava, you have to say that also on Shabbos that coincides with Pesach, and the Chida, for instance, says that the Maran, that's Rav Yosef Karo, didn't know one hundredth of the greatness of the Ari. They lived together in the same time period. There's a responsum in the writings of Rav Shulchan Aruch, the Tshuvos of Beit Yosef, addressed to Rav Isaac Luria, but the Mekubalim feel that Rav Isaac Luria kept his Kabbalistic knowledge secret, and therefore all that they knew about was the open Rav Isaac Luria, the public, the Nigla. They didn't know the Nistar, the secret. And the assumption of the Kabbalistic school is that anytime Rav Isaac Luria differs from the Shulchan Aruch, we assume that if the Shulchan Aruch had known what Rav Isaac Luria said, he would adopt that position, and therefore they reject the Shulchan Aruch in place of Rav Isaac Luria. We've already seen how for Rav Adi Yosef, you never reject the Shulchan Aruch. He's dominant in Eretz Yisrael, but as far as Rav Adi Yosef's concerned, this isn't even an Eretz Yisrael thing. Even in Chutz La'aretz, even you assume that when there's a dispute between the Kabbalists and the Halachists, we go by like the Halachists. And that's an old position as well, which you can find many great authorities in the Sephardic world as well who say that. Usually these authorities are before Isaac Luria. So, for example, the Radbaz and others talk about if there's a dispute between the Zohar and the Talmud, or the Zohar and the traditional halacha, you go by the traditional halacha. With Rav Isaac Luria, some held on to that position, but others said that no, Isaac Luria is of a different level. In any event, Rav Avad Yosef says, I don't know. I don't know where these rabbis, he's talking about the Chida and others, got this notion that if the Shulchan Aruch of Yosef Karo had heard what Rav Isaac Luria said, that he would adopt Isaac Luria's position. He says, "Im kol hakavod l'Rabbeinu Ha'ari, with all respect to the Ari, anan kaimalon lo b'shamayim hi. We have a principle that in deciding halacha, we don't look at heavenly things, we don't look at mystical things, we just look at arguments. So the fact that the Ari says this is what you're supposed to do, if you can't examine an argument, and if it's not through normal halachic channels, and arguments, Rav Avadia says we don't accept that. And who is going to tell us that we should haniach divrei haposkim for something, that we put aside the great poskim and adopt the Ari's position, kalacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, as if you accept it, kalacha Moshe Mi-Sinai, which means that you accept it without any questioning. And then he continues going, and then that would be bad enough for the Mekubalim. But then he goes further, and he says, even though the Ari is great, like one of the early authorities, he says, nevertheless, when we have others who say differently, and they're the majority, we go in accordance with their opinion, and then he says, and this is the problematic piece, the really problematic piece, the Chol Shekein, and all the more so, based on what Hagaon Rabbi Zalman, based upon what the first Lubavitcher Rebbe writes in the Tanya, in his letters, not the letters of the Tanya, I think they reprint them in the back of the Tanya, these letters, the Baal HaTanya, Rav Shneur Zalman of Ladi, quotes the Vilna Gaon. He had a lot of respect for the Vilna Gaon, even though the Vilna Gaon didn't reciprocate this respect. The Vilna Gaon even refused to see him. When Rav Vilna Gaon died, and there were Hasidim who were celebrating, Rav Shneur Zalman wrote a letter rebuking them, and he calls them, you know, the Hasid, me Vilna. He quotes the Vilna Gaon as the Vilna Gaon saying that he does a no ma'amin bekabbalah tari, that he doesn't believe in that the Kabbalah of Dari, bichlalutah in its essence, shikula mipi Eliyahu. Rav Shneur Zalman quotes the Vilna Gaon as denying the basic Kabbalistic idea that all these teachings, a revised Gurya, he was taught by Elijah the prophet. And the Vilna Gaon says that maybe a tiny bit, ma'at, came from Elijah, and the rest came from his Chachmato HaGadola, Ve'im Chiyuv HaMinba. The rest of the Ari's ideas came from his great wisdom, and there is no obligation to accept it, to believe it. And then he says that the Chaim of Elijah says the same thing. And therefore, why is everyone so interested, and what's the big deal in saying that we have to push aside the post scheme and accept the Ari? And he goes on. There are some who say that this position of the Vilna Gaon, which Rav Shneur Zalman mentions, that this really anti-Revised Agurya position, that the Vilna Gaon never could have said this, that since it's quoted by Rav Shneur Zalman, it must be that someone gave Rav Shneur Zalman Lashon Hara and told him something which isn't true. But that's not correct at all. That Rav Chaim of Lajin, he says, also mentions this position. And this is found in the Misnagdic world as well, that the Vilna Gaon did not feel bound by Rav Isaac Uria. This is what created enormous controversy, these words, because, and in fact, it were these words that Rav Yitzhak Nissen, who was the chief rabbi at the time and the leading Iraqi figure, this is what turned him against Rav Avadya. Until then, he had he had spoken to Rav Avadya, he had tried to make peace, he told Rav Avadya to retract some of the things he said, but he still remained a friend of his and still had his authority sort of shielding Rav Avadya, because there were those who wanted to put Rav Avadya in Cherem and do things like that. But when Rav Yitzhak Nissim saw this, publicizing that not everything of Rav Isaac Uria needs to be taken as from Elijah, and that he could be rejected in the name of the Vilna Gaon, that turned him against him, and this led to a break between Rav Nissim and Rav Avadya Yosef. And Rav Nissim even blocked Rav Avadya Yosef being appointed a dayan in Jerusalem. This is Rav Avadya Yosef therefore had to go back to Petach Tikva, but it was Rav Nissim who ruled, who used his authority to say that Rav Avadya Yosef is not deserving to be a dayan in Jerusalem. And this break between them would continue to Rav Nissim's death. And if you look at the Abiyah Omer and other books, you see how Rav Avadya refers to Rav Nissim. He does not give him the titles given to great rabbis. He doesn't call him Hagaon. He calls him maybe Harav Hagaon, but not Hagaon Harav. But some places doesn't even call him Harav Hagaon. He just calls him Harav. He doesn't refer to him as Zatzal. He refers to him as Zichrono Livracha. All the things that are signs that he doesn't respect him very much. Since Rabbi Nissim put a block on him becoming a Dayan, Rabbi Avadya Yosef in 1956 has to return to Petach Tikva to serve again as a Dayan there. And they were happy to have him back. In terms of responsa in volume two, that's worth noting. Just one, which I'll mention. This is Or HaChaim number 26, about turning lights, electric lights on Yom Tov. The issue is that in the Sephardic world, there were many who thought that it was permissible. The truth of the matter is, I would like someone, anyone, to explain to me why it's not permissible. I've read pretty much all the stuff on it. There's something really strange that if I can take a match, a lit match, and I could actually take a match and light a fire, light a barbecue with an actual match, that I couldn't, turn on a light. Especially since the early people always assumed that the problem with turning on a light is aish, fire. Now, maybe that's not the reason, but the early authorities assumed that that's what the issue was. It's like you're lighting a fire of sorts. And therefore, if you can light a fire, if you can transfer fire on Yom Tov, you should be able to turn a light on as well, because you're not creating from scratch. You're just the electricity is already there. And this was the position of the Aruch HaShulchan early on, and this was also the position of a number of Sephardic authorities, as well as some Ashkenazic authorities, but mostly not Ashkenazic. Or Tzvi Pesach Frank argued in favor of this, but the Ashkenazic position turned to be very much against that. Avadya was asked this precisely because it was a common practice in the Sephardic world, and he thought that there were problems with this, and he thought it was prohibited. The reason I said if someone could explain it, because if you look at the way they describe electricity, it doesn't seem, at least what people who know about this stuff have told me, none of the ways they describe electricity really are in line with the science. Or key cards. I mean, there are some poskim who think that these key cards, at least one posek I know in particular, who thinks that these key cards could be used on holidays. Because when you think of it, you're at a hotel. What's a key card? Why shouldn't it be able to be used? What's the isser? No one's really explained why these things should be forbidden. But in terms of lights, you have other issues here. So what does he say? He recognizes that there are many people who have the tradition to turn it on. And he says, however, you shouldn't do it. And you should tell people, especially people who are ready to listen, that we do not turn lights on Yom Tov. However, he says that in a place where they do it, ein limchot ben bechazaka, don't rebuke them too harshly. If you're gonna create controversy and it's gonna be an issue, don't get up and announce that you're violating. It has to be done tactfully. Others are more liberal and say in the Sephardic world that if this is already their practice, you don't even have to tell them at all. Rav Avadya Yosef didn't think that. He thought you should try to get them to change their position and not turn on lights. But this isn't like Shabbos. This isn't something you need to go to the mat for. If they're, if people have been doing it for 30 years, you can tell their children who are in your yeshiva not to let the parents continue doing what they're doing. Today, in the Ashkenazic world, I think we all do, none of us, as far as I know, turn lights on Yom Tov. In the Sephardic world, from what I've been told, the majority don't turn on, but there are still some who say you can turn on, and there are still Sephardic families who turn on lights on Yom Tov. I even was with a rabbi last week, a Sephardic rabbi, who tells his community they can turn it on because Rav Shlush and Netanya says you can, and others. I don't know, and you can write in at the bottom. I've never heard of any Ashkenazic rabbi who says you could turn lights on Yom Tov today, and they have the reasons why you can't. Not because of fire. Because of other things. Someone says Noad, all these different reasons. Rabbi Soloveitchik once said that he has a hard time deciding questions on electricity because he doesn't know how electricity is supposed to be understood. These things are very problematic. And There are changes going on as we speak, as people become more knowledgeable about electricity, and as our world is such that you can't move without electricity. For example, Rav Nachum Rabinovich of Maale Adumim, who definitely understands science and electricity. I would think he's the greatest posek now in the religious Zionist world. He holds that on, forget Yom Tov. Yom Tov, of course, you could do this, he thinks, but Shabbos. He holds that on Shabbos you can, and he has a piece about this. I can send anyone who's interested. You could walk through those electric doors. You know, the doors you come to and they open up. He thinks that you can walk through them on Shabbos. And for the religious Zionist world, there's no one really bigger than him. Although this psak I don't think has been accepted yet. But you can very easily see it being accepted. If someone like in Israel, you'll have people who follow it. But in America, if let's say a Herschel Schechter would be asked this question and he says it's permissible, then you can immediately see it becoming permissible because of his authority. And Rabinovich explains that, why it's permissible. It's no different. He thinks they're walking down the street and the lights go on. You don't intend for that. That psak I understand. Another psak of his I don't understand. He also thinks that you can use these faucets. Like if you go in a restroom, they have these faucets. He doesn't just think because of Kavod HaBriyos in the restroom. He thinks that there's no prohibition with these faucets where you put your hand and the electric guy sees your hand and the water comes out. The difference, I think there's a difference between the two because when you're going through the electric elevators, electronic elevators, you don't know, in other words, you're just walking. Someone decided to put in a door in front of you, but you don't care about the door and you don't want the door to be there. And you don't know when you take a step, which step is going to cause the door to open. And that's the argument he makes. But with the so that I understand. I don't understand the other argument he makes, and I asked one of his students to explain it to me. I still don't understand it, because with the faucet, you intend the water to come out. So you're putting your hand out there because you intend the water to come out. That's not like when you're walking to the door, when you put your foot out, you're intending to walk. You're not, and the door just happens to open. It's like you're walking down the street and the light goes on. You don't care about that, but when you put your hand forward, you're not putting your hand forward because you're walking forward or you're exercising your hand. You're putting your hand forward precisely because you want the water to come out. So it appears to me that it's different. But Rabinovich says that anything that happens is happening microscopically. You can't see it, that sort of thing. I say this only because this is a liberal an example we've seen so much in terms of stringency, that for a long time electricity moved in the direction of stringency. We're starting to see some movement in leniency, and I've already predicted in these shiurim many times. I've already predicted in these shiurim that I think we're going to see more trends to leniency because there'll come a time soon when you won't be able to get into an apartment building in New York City without a key card or something like that. As it is, when there's psukim on the books that say that you can't walk past a camera on Shabbos. Now, of course, that's impossible today because there's cameras on every single street corner and there's satellites taking our pictures. Sorry about this. I think when it gets to be too hard, they will go back to Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach's opinion. Rosh Shlomo Zalman Auerbach held that electricity is forbidden on Shabbos, really forbidden, when it makes heat or light. But other things, a key card, turning on air conditioning, things like that, he thought that it really is permissible, although the custom, the practice was that it was not. So therefore, he wouldn't permit it and says we have to go along with what the minhag is, the practice that we don't do it. But he didn't see that there was any problem plugging in a fan, for example, from a pure halachic standpoint. And I think that as we become more electronic, we're going to have to go back for that. I mean, there are people now saying that we can't use our, we have problem using our water on Shabbos because we have things, these meters, that they're electronic. Everything you do, basically, you need to, it affects something electronically. There'll be electronic toilets soon in our houses. So I think we're going to see more. And that's why, if you look in Rabinovich's Tshuva, he says that we're in this electronic age now, and Shabbos is supposed to be a time of joy, and we can't have a situation where, our lives are miserable. Like you're at a hotel and you have to stand outside, wait, it could be an hour in the cold, wait for someone to come and open the door. He says that now we have to find a way halachically that, and since he doesn't think that these things are halachically forbidden to begin with, he says we can now start pushing this in a different direction. So when, how much this continues, I don't know, but he is the most important Hezder Rosh Yeshiva and halachic authority in the religious Zionist world, although, as far as I know, not many have jumped on the bandwagon yet, but we'll see. Finally, and this is the last thing I want to do from Rav Ovadia Yosef, I wrote about this on the Svarim blog, but some of you probably didn't read it, so I'll repeat it as well. And I have a bit of a problem, I think, or I don't know, maybe I shouldn't have a problem with it. Let me tell you the story. Rav Ovadia Yosef told a story in this is a great book. It's called Rabbeinu. It was published within a year after his death by his chavrusa. His name is Shitrit, or he's more than his chavrusa. The last 20 volumes he published were prepared for publication by this man who he'd learn with him every day, and he recorded all their conversations. Every night after spending the whole day with Rav Ovadia, he'd write down what he was told. And Rav Ovadia told the following story to him. This is also in the Abiya Omer, but there's something that they left out. That he says that this is, goes from 2001. He says Rav Ovadia was writing, he's preparing for publication this responsa, which he originally wrote in 1956. He's a Dayan in Petah Tikva, regarding a couple from Russia that were civilly married and now wanted to get divorced, and the woman wanted alimony. The question is, does she get alimony? Is it because they weren't really married halachically? We don't need to get into the details now. But he says that when they began to sit the first sitting of the Beis Din, it was himself, it was Reuven Katz, who was the Av Beis Din, the chief rabbi of Petah Tikva. And it was someone named Yisrael Sapir, who I don't know anything about, but he was the other Dayan. And of those three Dayanim, of the first time they heard the initial case, Rav Ovadia Yosef was singular opinion. He was the one, and the two opposed him. Rav Ovadia thought that she shouldn't be given any support. And Rav Ovadia said, knew that this was incorrect. And he asked, you know, when they were finished, he asked Rav Karelitz. Rav Karelitz, he was another Dayan at Petah Tikva. He spoke to Rav Karelitz about the case, and Rav Karelitz said that I agree that there shouldn't be so any sort of alimony here. And then Rav Ovadia said to him, "I want you to, keep this in mind, and I'm going to call on you." What does that mean? Rav Ovadia Yosef was in charge of setting the times for the courts, and he set the time when the family, when the couple would come back, and they'd start it. They never really started; they just got the opening information, but the case hadn't really begun. He set it for a time that he knew Reuven Katz was not going to be available. So therefore, when he set it for this date, okay, Reuven Katz was, let's say, he was in Yerushalayim that day. So they had to go to the next person on the list. So who did they pick? Since it was just two Dayanim, Rav Ovadia asked the clerk to go call Rav Karelitz. And therefore, they when they had the case, they decided 2-1, and Rav Ovadia emerged victorious. In other words, Rav Ovadia Yosef stacked the deck. He describes this case as well in Yabia Omer Volume 9. And everything I told you is there, except for he doesn't say, he says, it was me, it was Reuven Katz, it was Yisrael Sapir. He says, "I spoke to Rav Karelitz about this, and he agreed with me." And he says, when the couple came next to do the continue with the court case, Reuven Katz was not around, and therefore we had to invite a third Dayan. And I told the clerk to call Rabbi Karelitz, and then with the majority, we were the majority. That's what he says in Yabia Omer. But in his conversations with Rav Shitrit, he says it wasn't just that Reuven Katz wasn't there, it was that he set the date. So that purposely he'd be able to pick the third Dalion. So is this problematic or not? If something seems problematic about it because this stacking the deck, but apparently not. When you think about it, and this is what I wrote about, everyone who goes before you have a woman, let's say, and she wants to get divorced. And there's two positions. One position thinks that anytime a woman wants to get divorced and she has a halfway decent reason, the court has to order the divorce. And another position says, no, you don't, you need to be much more serious. So what do you do? Well, if the woman, if you have a situation where it's the luck of the draw, the clerk decides who hears this case. If he happens to give a person a Dayan who has a stringent position, then the woman is already, she's lost before she starts. On the other hand, if the clerk happens to give randomly the more liberal judge, she's won. So would there be anything wrong if the clerk, for example, knows that this rabbi is more liberal and he supports, let's say, women's rights to purposely pick that? Or if someone, the Av Beis Din knows, he has his own position that he believes in a liberal perspective and he purposely picks a liberal dayan to be on the court. What Rav Avadia Yosef is saying that there is no problem. This doesn't mean that in the end, they'll come to a conclusion, but at least there's no problem with stacking the deck, that is, in making sure and picking a court that you assume before they hear the case, that their judicial philosophy is in line with the result you want to get to. Now, when we, if you watch Supreme Court nomination hearings, if you ask them, about Roe versus Wade, they'll say, I can't answer that because the case might come before me. But you can ask them about their general judicial philosophy. In this case, it seems Rav Ovadia Yosef went even further, although perhaps not. I mean, he simply asked about, there were no details per se, at least I don't think there were details per se. He was asking about, in general, if, does a civil marriage lead to alimony, things of that nature. It's hard. Let me take that back, because you can't tell from his responsum how much he told. He says that I spoke to Rev Karelitz about this, and he agreed with what I said. So maybe it does appear, actually, take back what I said, that Rev Avadia Yosef even told him the details of the case. I think some people might find this problematic, but Rev Avadia Yosef did not think it was problematic. And as I pointed out, if you're in charge of the court, let's say I'm the Av Beis Din and I get to choose the other people to sit with me, do I need to choose randomly, throw a coin? Or if we're going to hear an Aguna case, am I permitted to choose a Dayan who I know agrees with my philosophy? That doesn't mean that in this particular case he will, but at least you have a general sense that he'll agree with you. I don't think this is really any different than asking a Poseik a question if you know that he's pretty liberal in, let's say, in certain matters. As long as you're going to be bound to him, even if he gives you a stringent answer, but the fact that you know that he has a liberal perspective in this, why is that problematic to ask him? On the contrary, that's why people do ask him. And as long as they are bound by his decision, even if they don't get the decision they want, what's the problem? Do you have to ask a random Dayan or ask someone who is stringent? I don't think that's a problem at all. And as I've said numerous times, Rav Moshe Feinstein himself attributed his great fame to the fact that people asked questions, they liked the answer they got, so they asked more questions. They weren't going to be asking Rav Moshe questions if he was always giving them a negative answer, telling always a stringent answer. Okay, I didn't think that we would go the whole class, but we have one more class this semester, and we're finished now with Rav Avadia Yosef. We'll have one class with this individual. Take my word for it, in Europe he wasn't wearing the strimel. At least all the pictures I've seen of him with a strimel, he's in Israel. In Israel, there's a tradition, even for the Lithuanians, to wear strimels. But this is Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer, a very important figure, and we will have one class this semester dealing with him. We'll pick up immediately with him next class. But let me know if you have any questions or comments. Let me go through the questions here. So Moshe points out that the Mabit, Moshe Mitrani, says that there were no tefillin in the desert. And that is against not just what Rav Yosef Mesas says, that there was tefillin and they only had two parshios. It's against what Rav Avadia Yosef says. So thank you. The tshuvos min hashamayim. Moshe is referring to this selection of tshuvot by Rav Yaakov. He's a French scholar in which you have the question, and he says that he received a vision, and this is what the answer is. This volume is not given much weight at all among halachic authorities, and every time Rav Avad Yosef quotes it, because he always quotes it, he then says, "Lo b'shamayim hi," the Torah is not in heaven. So this is one of the interesting volumes of Tshuvot in medieval times, the Tshuvot from heaven. They tell us a lot about the thought processes of the author, but they have no influence in halachic literature. The altar said, Moshe says, did the altar say that the Ari had revelations greater than Moshe? What he says is that that the Ari's level of prophecy, what he received prophetically, was greater than Moshe. But he doesn't say, if you look carefully, he doesn't say that he knew things that Moshe didn't. He says that Moshe knew it through wisdom, through Chachma, but the Ari's prophetic level was greater than Moshe. But there are others who say, if I'm not mistaken, it's the Rav Tzaddok, who says that the Ari had prophetic visions that revealed stuff that even Moshe did not know. But if you look at the Baal HaTanya, he says that he seems to be saying that they each have the same knowledge, but for Moshe it comes through wisdom, and the Ari it doesn't. What this allows him to do is to say that the Ari was prophetically greater than Moshe, but he doesn't have to therefore say that the Ari knew more than Moshe. That would, I think, maybe create problems with the ninth principle of the Rambam, to say that the Ari had more advanced knowledge of God than Moshe did. So he says that Moshe had the same knowledge, but Moshe gets it through wisdom, and Chacham Adi Finavi, and wise is even better than prophecy. So, but the Ari had certain prophetic things that Moshe didn't have. But in my book, I quote Rav Tzaddok. Now, Rav Tzaddok, who says that, at least that's how I read it, that, hold on a second. I'll give you the source. If you look in the chapter dealing with, actually it's the ninth, not the ninth principle, it's the seventh principle, which is the uniqueness of Moshe. I quote actually, no, I don't quote Rav Tzaddok. I remember Rav Tzaddok, I quoted him in the first article, and I was wrong, so I didn't quote it in the book. He doesn't say that. He simply says, so it's only Rav Shneur Zalman. He says, because Moses only used prophetic powers, he was not able to reach the heights of Rashbi, Rav Isaac Uria, and the other Kabbalists. So they had a more profound understanding of divine matter. Oh, okay, I take back what I said. I didn't remember exactly. You're correct, sort of. He says that the Ari expounded many themes dealing with the Sefirot that even Moshe didn't know. And it's just the opposite of what I said. I misremembered. Moshe only used prophetic powers, and therefore he was not able to get to certain things. But the Ari was able. None of them reached Moses' prophetic level, which is what the Rambam says in the seventh principle. However, Chacham Adif Minavi, a Chacham could be wiser than a prophet. So what the Shneur Zalman says is that the Ari revealed stuff that Moshe didn't, not prophetically, but just through his wisdom. Someone wrote me a long piece on what I wrote and said that if you look at the Rav Shneur Zalman inside, this isn't really a violation of the 13 of the ninth of the seventh principle, and he explains why. And I'm going to write about it one day, and the idea, but at least that's the simple explanation, I think. And none of the Lubavitchers challenged what I said about the Tanya. Bill says that Jacob Katz writes about the Ari as not much of a halachist. Not, it's interesting you mention that, Bill, because the responsum that the Reversa Carr writes to Revise the Gloria, it's like a simple responsum, and anyone who had any halachic knowledge wouldn't be asking this question of Rav Yosef Karo. Therefore, among the Kabbalists, there is this tradition that this responsum is a forgery, and that Rav Yosef Karo never wrote it, because the Ari was not such a tyro, not such an amateur that needs to ask such a basic question. But other than the Kabbalists, no one assumes that this is a false tshuva. This is part of the collection of Rav Yosef Karo's responsa. I don't know if Yaakov Katz mentions that. I mean, the fact is that the Ari in his lifetime was not known as a halachist. He didn't write halacha. Moshe asks, would this explain his decision regarding the Dar Daim, that is, the people from Yemen who didn't accept the Kabbalah? It would. And Rav Avad Yosef's point is that Kabbalah is true, it's holy, but it's not an obligation. Not everyone needs to learn Kabbalah. And therefore, the Dar Daim and others are wrong, he says, but there's no obligation for everyone to learn Kabbalah, and therefore they're simply wrong about something they're not obligated to know or to learn. And we assume they have the status of like a shogeg, one who doesn't know any better. And that's what allows him to say that they're kosher. But you know, Rav Mordechai Eliyahu also, he also was able to justify the Dar Daim from the same idea that they don't know any better. Moshe says the Aruch HaShulchan, why do people assume he didn't understand electricity? He didn't understand it. He says, I don't. He says, if right in the little article there, based upon what I've been told, I forget his exact language, but it's clear he didn't understand it. He understood it like fire. That this is like fire, and you're transferring fire. If I recall, and I can check it for next time if you need to, but it's in the Kisvei Aruch HaShulchan. I think he even says, based upon what I've been told, if you assume it's fire. And there's fire in the wires, then we can understand why you would be permissible. But I don't think anyone would say today that there's actual fire in the wires. That's not what electricity is. It's very easy to say that we forbid electricity and we can't rely on the Aruch HaShulchan because he didn't understand electricity. My only point, which I said before, was that I don't, from what I see, I don't think that the Machmirim understand electricity either. And Rav Soloveitchik famously said, this was quoted by Rabbi Walter Wurzburger, that he didn't know how to paskin when it came to electricity. He found it very difficult because he didn't understand if electricity should be understood in accordance with one theory of it or another theory. The physics, Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach investigated physics in great detail. He was an autodidact, but he really knew the science behind electricity. That's very different. All these other poskim are deciding on electricity. They don't understand electricity. They never taken physics. They never taken high school physics, never mind college physics. And they're just coming up with all these reasons and everything. I think there's a good point to be made that we don't yet have people who are experts in science today writing on electricity. Or Shlomo Zalman Auerbach was an expert, and he came out very liberal on it. And Rav Nachum Rabinovich, as a PhD mathematician and one who understands science, he also understands it. But the typical post say, what does he know about electricity? He can say it's Nolad or it's Aish or it's any of these things. But I mean, it's very easy to say that. But if you don't understand how circuits work and you don't really know about electricity from a scientific perspective, just to mouth the words, it's Nolad or it's new, it's Makab Patish, or anything like, I don't know how that what that's what the Rav was saying. How much value do these statements have if you don't understand the underlying point? And it's the same thing in science, medical halacha as well. Bill says it's viewed as Noah. And they come up with all sorts of things. Rav Asher Weiss said that the Chazon Ish knew it had to be forbidden. The problem was why it's forbidden. That sounds of something that one of these academic type of scholars would say, but that's I saw Rav Asher Weiss quoted as saying that, and Bill quotes Rav Asher Weiss that work resulting from your presence is not considered your activity.
Yeah.
I think that the liberal positions are going to come about because it becomes impossible to walk down the street to get into buildings. What are you going to do? Rav Schechter also has a shiur on this, on the YU Torah. they went, I think it was a trip to Italy or Germany, one of these places that they went to, and lo and behold, they get to the hotel, and the hotel has these lights that go on automatically. So, what are you supposed to do for Shabbos? So, I gave a whole shiur there that, you're not supposed to go to a place like this, but if you're already there, it's not a problem. It's no different than walking down the street. So, when I take my group to Budapest, we get there, and this is before I even thought to think of these things, and lo and behold, the lights go on automatically when you're in the hallway. So I knew the psak, but the average person doesn't know that, and they're going to feel very uncomfortable. But I was able, and I did it now for the last 5 years. They turn off the lights for us. So while we walk, they just have the regular lights on. The lights stay on. Instead of going off and on, they stay on the whole time. So there's no Chilul Shabbos. But I tell the group that if it was a situation where we got there and we couldn't change hotels and the lights would go on and off, you're allowed to walk down the hallway, even though the lights go on. The only time you wouldn't be allowed to is if it was pitch dark in the hallway. Then you'd have to stay in the room all of Shabbos. I don't know if any of my people would do that. But technically, if it's pitch dark, you wouldn't be allowed to go in because then you really are benefiting from it. And this way, you can say you're not benefiting. However, even though the lights are on all of Shabbos, when you walk down the hall, you still pass the electric eyes and you hear a noise. You hear like a little noise because they're picking up your movement. They're just not putting the lights on. But that's 100% permissible. And that's no different than walking anywhere. Bill says that cameras were addressed by Rav Moshe Feinstein, Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, and allowed. They always were allowed. However, about a year before his death, Rav Elyashiv came out with a psak, or I should say his court came out with a psak, because in those days, who knows what he was saying, that you can't go to the Kotel. Because if you go to the Kotel, you pass through cameras. And Rabbi Rosen from Tzomet came out with a long piece against this, how he doesn't, first of all, who believes that Rav Elyashiv said it? And fundamentally, he says it's a misunderstanding of how these cameras work. But the point is, it really had nothing to do with going to the Kotel. If these cameras were a problem, you couldn't walk anywhere in Jerusalem. You couldn't walk down the street in New York City. So sometimes you know that a psak can't be correct because by it can't be correct because you can't live. And when Rav Elyashiv gave this psak, you have to assume that he was fed false information or he didn't understand the situation there. Because, first of all, this was a psak, a permissible psak that had been given for decades. After all, what do you care about the camera? You're walking past. You don't care. What does it matter what someone, if I'm on the street and someone takes out his camera and is videotaping me, does that mean I can't walk down the street? What does it have to do with you? And the people who are doing the camera are doing it for Sakonas Nefashos, for Pikuach Nefesh reasons. So the whole thing didn't make any sense. And I remember it created a bit of a controversy when it first came out, and then you didn't hear anything else about it. And even the great followers of Elyashiv didn't pay attention to it. Because I think they realized that, even though it was a Rav Elyashiv, there's something was wrong with this. You couldn't be a religious Jew today if that's the psak, because you couldn't leave your house. And even in my little town here of West Orange, New Jersey, satellites and things like that are taking our pictures. I'll wait on for one more minute because Moshe's typing something. Oh, Bill said the Rav once said jokingly, the Machmirim don't understand electricity, and the Mekilim don't understand halacha. He might have been referring to Emanuel Rachman and maybe some others, because Rachman, I'm told, that Rachman believed it was okay to talk on the telephone on Shabbos. Was it Shabbos or Yom Tov? Yom Tov. I think it's Yom Tov. I can't remember now whether it's Yom Tov or Shabbos. He definitely believed it was okay to talk on the telephone on Yom Tov. So don't forget what I said about Shabbos. He believed it was okay to talk on Yom Tov. I don't know Shabbos. There was someone else, not Rachman, who I thought that it would be okay on Shabbos. Rachman gave the psak that during the 60s, because it was dangerous in New York, he said that you can carry something on Shabbos, carry some money, so that if you're mugged, you can give it. Moshe says. The Rashba says the Parsha's film was 70 and Shias B'Shaim. Rav Vadia quotes that. He quotes that right in the Tshuva. So I'm impressed that You knew that, but as I said, it's right there in Revadia. Yeah. Okay, Bill, thank you for that about the analog old phones. Good night, everyone. We'll pick up next week with Rav Isser Zalman Meltzer leaving Sfarad and take us back into the heart of Litvisha Judaism. Good night, everyone.